We have a quorum. We'll call the meeting of the House Transportation Policy and Finance Committee to order. Representative Gauthier, you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the minutes of the previous meeting.
Representative Gauthier moves the adoption of the minutes. Everyone had a chance to look at them. Is there discussion? Hearing none, let's vote. All in favor signify by aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members, we have a bill in front of us today. House File 80 from Representative Nornes. Representative Nornes, if you'd approach the testifier table, we'll have someone move your bill to get it in front of us. And I don't believe there are any author amendments, are there?
There is an amendment.
There is an amendment?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's. Oh, here it is. I see it. Okay.
The A1 amendment.
Let's have Representative Liger, do you want to move House File 80? And before you do, where do we want to send this after this? To the floor? Possible inclusion. Move it to get it in front of the committee. We'll hold this over for possible inclusion in a policy omnibus bill, okay?
I'd like to move...
Representative Liger.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 80 and to hold over for an omnibus bill later on.
Okay. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Nornes, do you want the, is the A1 amendment yours as well?
It's actually from the agency.
From the agency?
From the Department of Transportation.
Well, I'll tell you what, then let's have you explain your bill and stand for questions, and then we'll talk about the amendment.
I would also at this time like to invite Dale Graff to come forward to help me. This is not a difficult bill to explain, but... the company works for is the reason for us being here today. And what this bill does is basically looks for a permit for hauling large boat lifts and docks and so forth. And so, Dale, do you want to
point to point? Are you done setting your bill up then? Is that your explanation, Representative? Would you like to proceed with an explanation? Then we'll ask Mr. Graff to testify.
I think I've explained it. It's very simple. It's about two lines long. So we're just looking for a permit. To add to a list of other permits already authorized to allow these types of oversized waterfront structures to be hauled without having to be fined, because that's the current system, because if they don't have a permit and they're caught hauling these things, our troopers are very nice and friendly, but they fine them at the same time. So that's essentially what we're here to correct.
To fix. Mr. Graff, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the folks who are listening at home on the internet and for the secretary, that'd be great. And then proceed with telling us about the bill.
My name is Dale Graff. I'm from Fergus Falls, Minnesota. I work for a company called Lake Area Docks and Lifts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay.
Proceed.
Okay. Really, the reason we're asking for this is that there is a single trip permit available, but... we make, in the springtime, we make between 10 and 15 trips per store. We have three stores per week. So that's about 30 single trip per store per week that we have to get a single permit for. If we could get an annual permit, it would significantly reduce our workload. And I estimate there's about 400 dock and lift dealers in the state of Minnesota. I think specifically what we're hauling are boat lifts, and the boat lifts are built. The oversized boat lifts are 120 inches wide, and they're built for pontoon boats. So they're pre-assembled at our store and then hauled to a lake place, typically 5 to 10 miles.
Okay. Pretty simple, straightforward request and testimony. Are there questions of the testifier or the bill author? Is there anyone in the audience from MnDOT that would like to testify regarding this matter? Anyone?
We need to add our amendment. It's the A1 amendment. I don't think we've done that.
Well, Representative Nornes, would you consider this an amendment that's friendly to what you're trying to do?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's have Representative Leidiger. Do you want to move the A1 amendment as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment to the to HF 80.
Okay. We have the amendment before us then. Representative Nornes, explain quickly how the amendment amends what you're trying to do here.
If I can have the Department of Transportation explain it.
Certainly. Please proceed.
My name is Gene Halverson for the Department of Transportation. One of the units I have is the overdimensioned transportation permits. And what we wanted to do here is we have an existing annual permit for boats. And so we thought instead of creating a whole new permit, which costs us money to go to the software company to get that done, we could use the boat permit and revamp it, and it would save quite a bit of money. So that's our only reason for the amendment.
Mr. Halverson, then, does that permit still cost the same as the other permits? No special upcharge to the person looking for the permit, is there?
Mr. Chairman, no, sir. There wouldn't be. It would still be $120 for the season.
Thank you. To the amendment members, to get the bill cleaned up and in the shape for which the author wishes it, is there further discussion to the amendment? Questions of the of MnDOT? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor, signify by aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. House File 80 is amended. Thank you, Mr. Halverson. Any other questions for either the testifier or for Representative Norris? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is for MnDOT, but it could be for Representative Norris also. The question I have here, and just so I get this straight in my mind, right now they have to take out a permit for every one of these docks they move. And we're just going from having a single permits to allowing the dealers to have an annual permit so they could haul all the ones that they'd have to haul all year long.
Gentlemen, either one?
So that's basically what we're doing. The bill is doing. Okay.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, I thank you for this because I have a manufacturer in my district. But my question is, what were they paying for the one-time permits? What were they? Now they're going to be having an annual one. What were they paying for each time they got a permit?
Representative Nornis, was it actually a permit or a fine?
Well, both.
Okay.
I understand there were some fines paid, but I don't know. I don't know the number.
You, Mr. Halverson, can you help us with that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, it's $15 for a single trip permit.
So they could get a single trip permit for $15, and now we're going to give them blanket permits to do this for. About 60?
No, Mr. Chairman, it's $120.
$120.
But with that, they can make as many trips as they want during the 12-month calendar year.
Mr. Chair, I think it's
Representative
part of it's just making business a little easier. But it's a lot of extra work to have to apply every time, and I don't know how much notice you'd have. You know, consumers of those products want delivery fast. You know, you don't want to wait too long to get your new doctor, your new lift. Summer's too short for that. So I think it just makes business better. A small business, for example, mm-hmm. we're talking about today, more efficient.
Thank you, Chairman.
Mr. Halverson.
You have to remember, too, that it's less work for us. We issue one permit per year for this company versus every time they want to move a dock or a boat lift. And these are normally docks and boat lifts that are within a certain size envelope. These are not the huge earth-moving equipment, for instance. Those are single-trip permits because we have to find routes and those kinds of things. So.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to kind of close the loop on this. The one-time permit would still be available, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Morrow, that's true. They'd still be available.
Thanks for clarifying. Further questions of the testifier or the author? Is there anyone else in the audience that feels compelled to testify for or against this House file? Seeing none, Representative Nornis, thank you for bringing the bill to committee. We will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in a transportation policy bill.
Thank you.
And again, I'll give you the assurance that if there is no bill, we'll notify you and you can move it separately at another time.
I would appreciate that, too.
Thank you. Members, we'll call down now some our folks from Minnesota or MnDOT to talk about the 10-year highway investment plan, if you'll see that on your agenda. Peggy Reichert. Ms. Reichert, welcome to the committee. Mr. Henkel, welcome to the committee with her. And members, in your packet, there are colored handouts that will match the slides that we're going to hear about shortly. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to identify yourself for the record and proceed, we'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peggy Reichert, and I'm the Director of Statewide Highway Planning at MnDOT. So I work with all the districts and the specialty offices in pulling together our long-range highway plan and our mid-range highway investment plans. So I'm going to give you today a brief overview. I know we only have a few minutes here, so of what, how we put together the 10-year plan. We have a 20-year plan, and we also have within that a 10-year plan. How we do that, how it relates to our overall planning and programming process, which I believe Abby McKenzie gave you an overview on 2 weeks ago. I understand you're interested a little bit in how we set our investment priorities and select projects to build, and then what our investment plan looks like for the next 10 years and what our expected performance on the system will look like as a result of those investments. So our overall process, it starts over here on the left side with our statewide multimodal transportation plan, which addresses all the modes and how transit and highways and airports and all fit together. And then we do investment plans in each of those areas, and we do one for the highway system. These are capital investment plans. And we update these plans on every 4 years now. Last year, the legislature, you passed a new bill that requires that we do this planning every 4 years. But we also, within the 20-year highway capital plan, we update the first 10 years annually because there's a lot of changes in revenues and costs, and we want to keep that very current. The overall planning process is a pretty elaborate process, but to be simple with it and to explain it to you here, the first step is we try to identify what are the needs that we have on the system. And this isn't all the things that everybody would necessarily want, but what we've tried to do is set performance targets for the system to keep the system in a state of good repair. So we have targets for structural integrity of bridges, the pavement quality, the life cycle cost to keep our signs and signals in good condition. We have targets for safety, reducing the fatalities and crashes on the roadway. We have mobility targets for our major highways connecting all of Minnesota for the interregional corridors. We try to keep them traveling at a certain average speed over the corridor. So we have a method to analyze what are all the needs in those areas. And then in addition, we know that there's a lot of local needs that communities want to support their quality of life and local economic development. So we have an estimate of those. The next step is to project our revenues. And this last time we did the overall plan in 2009, we did have the new funding that was authorized under Chapter 152, but we didn't assume any other additions, just natural kind of growth that we've had in federal and state funding. So these revenue projections are really a snapshot in time. They're what we thought then, and that's why we have to update this every year, at least the 10-year period. So the next step then is to set our investment goals and then develop the plan and then identify high priority options for if we did get any additional funding, what would we do with that. The when we did this in 2009, I think you've heard about this, that we added up that we came up with about $65 billion in a very rough cost estimate of what we would need over the next 20 years to meet all of these performance targets and address some of the high priorities that our regions or communities had. And our projected revenues were about $15 billion. So the tough job was to set to figure out how to balance that funding over all of these needs, and we tried to have a balanced program that would address these four strategic priority areas of safety, mobility, maintaining the infrastructure in good condition, and addressing some of the regional and community priorities. And in developing what was the right balance, we had, first of all, legislative direction on Chapter 152, which set some aggressive targets to dealing with the bridges and repairing and replacing all the structurally deficient or fracture-critical bridges in the state by 2018. So that was something that we took as a given. We also looked at our system performance trends, what we needed to keep things in a state of good repair and keep traffic moving around the state. And stakeholder input was very important, people telling us what was important to them. And we have consistently heard that keeping things in good repair is very important to the residents and citizens of Minnesota. So when we put together the overall plan, it's really done by each of our eight districts do this in conjunction with the specialty offices, and then they each, as you heard a couple weeks ago, they each get a share of the funding as allocated out to them, and then they put together their overall plan, and then we roll that up into the statewide investment plan. And we have guidance to make sure that all the districts are doing this in a consistent manner. And so the directives that went out to the districts was, of their funding that they had, their share of federal and state funding, the first thing they had to do was make sure that they had funded all the Chapter 152 bridges, and then we also had some money that's just that you had designated for interchanges alone, so that went in there. Then the second thing was we said we need to take care of the other bridges that weren't included in the Chapter 152 program, and we said we need to do about, if we do about 85% of the need, we think we'll be in pretty good shape there. In the safety area, our directives come from the highway safety plan that looked at what were the types of crashes around the state and that were really the ones that were causing fatalities or very type A injuries, which are life-changing injuries. Mm-hmm. And there we looked at things to prevent those, which are really, we focused on a lot of low-cost, high-benefit investments that would keep people on the traveling lane of the road. So rumble stripes are very effective, and centerline rumbles are very good, and markings on major curves and things like that. And then also intersections are a major cause of fatalities in cities. So those are the emphasis there in the safety area, was to put funding towards those things. And then other infrastructure, our signs, our signals, lighting, those things also wear out, and so we try to keep them on a different life cycle in reinvestments, that we keep them in good condition. So we said to the districts, now you need to put some money into that. And then after that, whatever's left, we said put about 70% of what you have left into pavement. And then whatever's left after that was at district discretion. And that really was a lot of other things, like some districts decided to put it into additional infrastructure because they need their pavements needed more. Some thought safety capacity projects were the most important to their stakeholders, so they put it there. In the Twin Cities, they did a lot in congestion mitigation, is where they're putting their area trying to do. And because there's not a lot of funding left after you do the first things, the emphasis has really been on trying to find the low-cost, high-benefit types of things and to spread the funding around the entire system so we benefit as many people and as many travelers as possible.
Ms. Riker, could you stand for a question for just a moment?
Sure.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you got a lot left to go, and I'm hoping that questions along the way aren't going to take up too much time, but I've got a specific one on these. In the center of the road, you put these bumps. What are those called again?
Centerline
rumble strips. Thank you. By putting those in, this is a safety issue. Do we have data which shows that this really does help?
Yes.
Ms. Riker,
can you answer a little bit about it?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Leidiger.
Yes, and I'm sure our traffic office would be happy to come and share with you the results of that, but they have found that it really does help people. They're really aware when they're going off the line, and it does keep people.
Representative Leidiger, your follow-up?
Yes, sir, because that is like the number one thing that the constituents talk to me about. What are we going to do with these rumble strips? It is, the noise apparently is just out of control. So the question is if it is not of that much value, we probably shouldn't be doing this if it is noise pollution. And I don't have an answer, but I'm sure you're getting the same kinds of questions. What are you doing about it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidinger, I do think it'd be a great topic for the traffic office to come talk with you about. But the districts, they try not to put rumble stripes, particularly the edge stripes, in real urban areas where there's a lot of housing. They'll actually take them out in some of those. So they're trying to be selective where they put them. And they have taken them out where there have been a lot of noise complaints. So, you know, like many things, there are trade-offs between the safety benefits and the noise benefits, and unfortunately it's not a perfect world where you always get the right thing. So, you know, they're trying. They don't just blanket put them every place, but they are very effective, and they have really been. District 3, the St. Cloud Brainerd area, has done a lot of them, and they've kind of led the way on that and found it very, very helpful.
Perhaps after financial deadlines, we'll have a discussion about some of the pretty interesting traffic safety things that have been done over the last handful of years. And the results we've noticed, as you'll notice, are fatalities to continue to decline, thank goodness, every year, even though vehicle miles stay up. And a lot of it has to do with things like this. Further questions? Ms. Reichert, you can proceed if you'd like, and then we'll come back to a few questions if we can.
So within this 20-year highway investment plan, we have the first 4 years is the STIP, which we call the State Transportation Improvement Program, and then the next years 5 to 10 is sort of the mid-range, and then 11 to 20 is the long-range years. And so this 10-year cycle, we update it every year, so it's kind of a rolling, we move forward the 10 years. And we do this because revenues change. We did have a reduction in this last biennium of $150 million because of declines in the gas tax and sales tax on vehicles. Some of that was made up with some of the ARRA funding that came in. But we do have changes in revenues. We've also been operating, as you know, with the federal funding on a lot of continuing resolutions, and so we never quite know what it's right now. It's been a very difficult time trying to kind of keep this up to date. Every time you say something, it changes almost the next week. But that's why we update this annually, to see where we are. Also, construction costs have been, you know, they were really increasing a lot in the around 2007, 2008, and then, of course, with the recession, we've been getting better bids on a lot of projects, so things have gone down. So we try to adjust our cost estimates. And then our investment priorities, whether they have shifted. We have reassessed. Last summer we looked at, when we were updating this plan, did we want to change the investment priorities that I just went through in the last slide, and decided no, we needed to stay with that. So when we put together this 10-year plan, the first, if a project is identified in the first 4 years in the STIP, the department tries to, we basically consider that a commitment. Now, it may be that funding or the cost estimates change so that the year might change, but that's pretty much committed. But projects that are in years 5 to 10 are still so, you know, they're still out there, and so while that's our plan and we're working on them, we don't consider them to be a complete commitment, and they're still in the scoping phase, and just what that project may look like was still subject to a lot of design and engineering work. This is what the current outlook for 2011 through 2020 is, that we have $7.2 billion. This is just on the capital side now, not operating. And our current plan is that most of them, the bulk of this money is in keeping the system in a state of good repair. The Chapter 152 bridges is about 21% of the funding. Other bridges is another 11%. So you can see bridges is a big part of the spending plan. Pavement is about another third, 30%. And then the other areas, whether it's preservation of other infrastructure, dealing with the safety issues, some of our preventive safety. We have a few projects that are safety capacity, where we're actually adding lanes or interchange improvements to address safety. And then a little bit of money into mobility. The other category includes right-of-way and some set-asides and for cooperative agreements and some other expenditures. So overall, it's $7.2 billion. It's another way of looking at the first 4 years of the STIP is about $3.2 billion, and then $3.9 billion for the last 6 years, 2015 through 2020. The question of how do we actually select then the individual projects, after the districts decide how much money is in each general category, like bridges or pavement or safety, they then go to more specialized plans and models that tell them what projects to do. So, for instance, in the pavement area, we have a very elaborate pavement model that has every segment of the highway system. We go out and know what condition it's in every year. We know what type of road it is, how much traffic's on it, so we have a model that projects how fast that pavement will deteriorate, and then fix what's the right fix to go on that road and what year that should happen. And we have the same thing with the bridge. We have a big inventory of bridges. They're inspected annually. We look at that. We decide what needs to be done. And so the specialty offices have recommendations. They talk to the districts. And then the districts know what their local partners need, and they also know what is going on in their district very well. And so they may put together a bridge job with a pavement job and at the same time then add on these safety treatments that the traffic office has done a lot of research to figure out what are some good things to do there. In the Twin Cities, for mobility, a lot of the mobility projects will be a bridge project, and then they may do some pavement work and at the same time fix a part of the highway where they have discontinuity on lanes, where a lane is dropped, and they'll sort of try to fit that in. So they're trying to really stretch the funding as far as possible and match all these projects up together, and also at the same time coordinate with their local communities who may have a need for an intersection improvement because they've got a new business coming in, or they need to rebuild their utilities, and so they're trying to do the timing of that. So it's actually selecting the projects goes through a lot of steps and a lot of consultation with our specialty offices and then also with everyone, with the stakeholders. In some areas, like the regional community improvement programs, there for the interchange programs that the legislature set up and funded with first Chapter 152 and then subsequent legislation under Chapter 136 and 388, those were special competitive programs where criteria was set up. People applied, they were all evaluated, ranked one against another, and then the funding was allocated in that way. So most of our projects are put together through work with the specialty offices that kind of start with suggesting what needs to be done to keep the system in a good state of repair. Some of them are done on a competitive basis. This is just a list in this 10-year plan. We do have a lot of really major bridge projects. This is just a list of some of them. They're spread all around the state. Some of them have already been let, and some of them are still in the planning stages. And overall, our projected performance with this investment plan, again, remembering that we estimated that to meet all of our performance targets would take about $65 billion, and we had about $15 billion. So we are on track to meet our targets in bridges and to fulfill the directive that we've received from you on the Chapter 152 bridges. We're on track to reduce fatalities. We're not on track to meet our pavement targets. We don't think we're totally on track with other infrastructure. We do have some concerns with drainage around the state and whether we're dealing with a lot of the aging culverts that are under the roads and the signs and signals and some of that. Our Greater Minnesota Interregional Corridors are on track. They're all going to be meeting their targets. But obviously in the Twin Cities, we think that freeway congestion is probably going to increase. We don't know just what right now. The recession has probably kept some traffic travel down, so we aren't seeing quite as much congestion as we had. So this is our overall safety trend. This is the total number of fatalities on all state and local roads, and we have really feel like we've been very successful there in reducing fatalities. We would like to reduce them to zero. In the Twin Cities, we have the green line there is what was the original trend line back from 1993, if we've been going. So we've been kind of going up and down, and we've made some success. Some of the major projects have helped keep things, and also I think the overall reduction in travel has kept congestion kind of on this. But generally congestion, the trend line is going up. We're just trying to keep the trend line from not being quite so dramatically increasing. And I think this is the big concern to the department, is just that we have 12,000 miles of road trunk highways. We have what we call 14,000 miles of directional road, because we count, if you have a divided highway, that's considered two roads. And as you can see, we have two categories of roads, the principal arterials and non-principal arterials. And principal arterials include the freeways and the major arterials and expressways around the state, the ones that carry the most the traffic. And then we have the non-principal arterials. And our goal is on the principal arterials, we would like to keep 70% of the system in good condition. And you can see we're already at over 60%. You know, we're almost down to 60%, and that's going to fall to around 58% by 2020. And we'd like to have principal arterials only 2% be in poor condition. A road that is in poor condition is really in poor condition. It's very bumpy. You can't really travel at the posted speed. Your coffee will spill in your cup. And once you get in that condition, you almost have to really just tear it up and totally reconstruct it. So we don't like to get roads in that condition. But you can see that the percentage is going up, and the percent that's going poor from 400 miles to 900 miles are going to be in poor condition. And the non-principal arterials are the same category. Those may be lower volume roads, but those are roads that are important lifelines to a lot of the communities around the state. And those, the number of roads in good condition are going down, and the number of roads in poor condition are forecast to increase a lot. And we are looking at what to do about this, and we're working on that. So that is kind of the overview.
Ms. Reichert, thank you. I've got a couple of questions. Representative Hornstein, would you like to?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Ms. Reichert, and thank you for your work in implementing Chapter 152. That's important to many of us. I was wondering if you see a relationship between your slide 15 and your slide 5. So you we have 2,500 miles of road in poor condition, and we have a $50 billion gap between what's available in terms of funding and the need. Are we? Is the trend line for roads in poor condition related to the gap between available funding and the need?
Ms. Reichert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I think that would be a safe assumption, yes. If we had more money in one of our, back here in our long-range plan where we said what we would do if we had more money, one of the things we would do is put it into pavements.
So, and Mr. Chair, so then what? So can you give me maybe like a real-world case study of, you know, what's literally falling through the cracks in our state because of the gap between need and available resources?
Ms. Reichert or Mr. Engel, either one.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I believe that what's really falling through the cracks is our pavement conditions. That's the major thing. We're also concerned about we did a risk assessment. We had a big discussion in the department in November where all the districts came together and all the division directors and all the specialty offices, and we talked about what did we think were the biggest risks with this investment plan and with this funding level. And we said that really the first was pavement. And we are concerned about other infrastructure, about drainage. Because if you have a culvert fall apart, that's a bad thing, and we're just really trying to get our hands around what's involved there. We also know that there's a lot of communities that would like interchanges, intersection improvements, roadway improvements, and in terms of risk that we hear from them a lot, that's a risk. Yeah. I think those are the key areas.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Hart, thank you. One last quick comment, and sure. I appreciate that. I hope this serves as a wake-up call because you know, if we're going to be a state that's competitive, not only with our neighbors but in the global market, we're going to have you know, infrastructure that's first rate. And I don't like the trend that I'm seeing here, and I hope that we can you know, work to correct that. So thank you very much.
Let's see, Representative Szymanski, I think, is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Reichel, looking at the slides on page, let's see, must be slide 9, roughly, the question I have, the bridge replacement is about 32% of your capital investment budget. are we taking a fairly aggressive drive at replacing bridges in the near term? Will at some point we reach a point where we've got the bridges pretty well taken care of and that percentage investment could be reduced or channeled in some other direction?
Ms. Leidy, or Ms. Reichert, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that what we're seeing in bridges is that we built a lot of the system was built in the 50s, 60s, 70s, a lot of the interstate system. And bridges last maybe 60 to 75 years, those big bridges. So they do, they kind of have, we kind of call them like the baby boom, the bridges kind of had a boom. And so we're taking care of a lot of them in this 10-year plan. We still have some in the next decade, but we do think that we're getting, that Chapter 152 helped us get focused, and we are making a good dent on those bridges. So then bridges aren't like, pavements wear out pretty fast if you drive on them. They constantly need to be kept. But the bridges last longer, and so once you replace them, you'll buy some time so you can do some other things before they come back.
Thank you. Just for our consideration, too, the 152 bridges are the ones that we've identified in Chapter 152 for what we call fracture critical, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Bridges that had been built to 1950s engineering standards, members, where if one component breaks, the bridge goes down. The new design standards are different than that. They're non-fracture critical, where they have multiple pathways, so if a component breaks, the bridge does not collapse. So it's not necessarily just that the bridges are getting old in this case, but that we've learned so much about bridge safety over the decades that all the new design standards are built with much more redundancy and robustness and cost more than it cost to build a comparable bridge, say, in 1959. And so we're kind of replacing those with this chapter of law, if I'm not mistaken. You can comment if you wish. It's just an observation for the committee. And while we're ruminating on that, Representative Hausman had some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I could. One is to the issue of pavement. My understanding is in Minnesota and maybe in this country generally, we build more shallow than European roadways, where they build much deeper. And as a result, our pavement deteriorates more quickly. When I asked this question a number of years ago, I was told, well, that's because they have a higher gas tax and they've got more money. And that's why they build deeper. But when you see that $50 billion difference between needs and revenue and our quality, does it make one wonder whether we ought to revisit that idea of how we build them?
Ms. Reichert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, a couple things. I don't know the answer to your question about how they do it in Europe versus here. I think our pavement guys should come on and talk to you about it. I've heard that. But I think that the $50 billion gap, of that, $38 billion was to deal with congestion in the Twin Cities, because that... this old plan was before the new Metro Council and Metro District Plan, where we were going to just add lanes all over the place. And that was $38 billion to add a lane to everywhere on the freeway system. So the Metro District, their new plan, has a new approach, realizing that we're never going to have that much money. They have their new approach that they're trying to do to... add, you know, doing auxiliary lanes here, doing a lot of low-cost, high-benefit things, trying to do advantages for transit, min-pass lanes, a number of different things to try to give people alternatives and smooth the system and do what they can do. So they now have, so I think when we update this overall plan next year, the total cost may be different than the $65 billion that we have now. So we've already kind of said, what can we do about that $50 billion gap? But there still is a big gap in pavement.
Mr. Chair, I guess the reason I assumed it was pavement, when I look at the chart on this slide 12, it looks as though the worst that we have is pavement. Even that looks worse even than Twin Cities Freeway congestion. So I was just basing my question on that. Then my other question has to do with, once districts have determined their and MnDOT makes its statewide determinations, does economic impact enter in at all? I didn't see it here in terms of guidance and investment priorities, but do you, especially now because we are in these economic hard times, do we ask where would it have the greatest economic impact if we focused our dollars?
Ms. Reichert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, that's a good and complex question. We have a 12,000-mile highway system that serves all parts of the state, and in that we have designated 5,000 or about 3,000 miles of it as interregional corridors. And those are the most important roads that connect all parts of the state. And so they not only make sure that you can move goods and people all over from every major trade center in every region, so it's to give sort of an even playing field to the whole state in terms of supporting the economy. So everyone's connected. And we want to keep those roads in good condition with pavements, with the bridges, and this interregional corridor mobility target, which is to keep, so you can travel on them without a lot of congestion. So that's like I-94 to Fargo-Moorhead and 35 up to Duluth and 52 down to Rochester. Those are that system. So I think from an economic standpoint, those are the roads that carry the freight, that carry the travel, that those are really the critical things. So in terms of the overall economy, we think keeping those in a good state of repair and keeping them pretty much congestion-free is the way to go. The other issue I think that you're referring to is, if we do this, will we get some development in that community? And I think the hard thing there is to know, is that new development to Minnesota, or is that just moving it from one part of the metropolitan area to the other? And it's very hard for us to evaluate and know what that is. Now, when it does come time for interchanges, where we've done this solicitation and we've ranked the interchanges, one way we have tried to say, is there an economic benefit, is if the local partners are willing to put some funding into it because they think it's going to have benefits. So those are more, that's kind of our economic development programs have been more with the interchanges, where we're trying to give people access to specific locations. So I'm not sure I've totally answered your question, but it's a very complex question. But I think we think that keeping an overall basic network in good repair that connects everybody that's kind of our commitment to economic development.
It sounds then you wouldn't prioritize one over another. I mean, just listening to the three examples you gave, I mean, I might observe there's far more growth and activity right now in the Rochester area. So of those three you cited, that just from an economic perspective, we might put a higher priority right now on that corridor. But it sounds like that may not be part of what enters in.
Ms. Reichert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I think that the direction we've sort of been hearing is to try to, you know, all parts of the state are important, and so we have tried to connect to all the major trade centers in the state so that we have this backbone system of about 3,000 miles of road that is really our priority to support the economy of the state. So we don't want to favor, I mean, just because Rochester's doing good this year, Fargo-Moorhead needs to go. I mean, we have all parts of the state that need to have an essential level of access and mobility.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just an observation and a request, and not to necessarily go back to the centerline rumble strips, but certainly in areas where they're two-lane rural highways with traffic counts of 10,000 or more vehicles a day, and there's no funding to do an expansion, but we have safety concerns. I know in my area, in Area 7, we've put in those centerline rumble strips because it's better for those to try to limit those crossover accidents, not to deny that there may be places where they shouldn't go, but I am grateful that they were put in my area. The request I would have of either Ms. Reichel or Mr. Henkel is that in the past, Mr. Chair, we've seen a statewide map that looks like varicose veins of pavement that has 0 to 2 years of life left. For the life of me, Mr. Chair, I cannot find it. So if Mr. Henkel or Ms. Reichel could maybe send the entire committee a link to that map so we can get a sense of the scope of the pavement preservation problem.
Representative Morrow, that's a great observation. We actually had a presentation, we'll tee it up here, where your engineers come and tell us how the coffee cup test actually works. Are you doing that in a Buick or are you doing it in my old Chevy pickup? They ride entirely differently. And there actually is objective measurement techniques that I found pretty interesting to know. And with that was the map of pavement life and quality and so on and so forth and how it relates to safety and how it relates to sensitive freight, so on and so forth. Perhaps after we're through with our budget things here and we have some time to invest, drill down deeper, we'll do that again. Thank you. Let's see, Representative Leidiger. Or was it to this issue, Representative Eakin? Representative Leidiger is teeing up next. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. To pick up on what Representative Hausman was talking about on the possible under-engineering of roads, my concern, being an engineer, is also on over-engineering. And specifically, I know that we have this complete streets legislation, which really forces planning to go through a lot of work that, and actually I don't know what the percentage is, but in which a great percentage of the time you're never going to go in that direction, do all the engineering that's really requested in that kind of legislation. Can you tell me what that fiscal impact is on
Ms. Reichert or Mr. Hanks
on that
one
legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, I think we're just getting into that program, so we don't really, it's almost still in almost pilot stage. We're trying to figure out what does it mean, what is the complete street, where are they appropriate. Not every complete street doesn't mean every street is going to carry all modes. But at the same time, I think a lot of the roads that we're dealing with aren't the ones that people are concerned about having. I think of the county roads and the city streets that are much more getting the demand to be complete streets than a lot of our trunk highways.
Okay. Representative Murray, or follow-up? Or
can I just do a quick follow-up? Are we going to... Do we, I mean, especially since we're talking about a $50 billion, you know, shortfall, do we don't have any really idea of how much more this may cost at this point?
Let me offer a suggestion that at some point here in the future, perhaps next year even, as they get into it a little more, we'll have an overview of what's entailed with that and what the engineering costs could be and so on and so forth, because it also affects bridges, I think, as well. Any new bridge design that MnDOT does, they have to weigh a complete streets design and the additional cost of that. So we'll come back to this and visit it again. Representative Murray, I think you're up next here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. The first is a follow-up to Representative Hordenstein's question on our needs and our revenues. A comparison of neighboring states around us. Are we competitive with what they're doing? Are they finding the same needs and revenue problems that we are? Because as I drive for business around Iowa, Wisconsin, and South Dakota, I hit an awful lot of tough roads out there too. And just wondering if are we competitive or are we behind what other states are doing?
Ms. Reichert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murray, I don't know exactly. I think it's, but I do know it's a national trend that all of our colleagues and all of the DOTs around the state, around the country, are facing these issues. Because I think we all have a lot of infrastructure that we've maybe taken for granted for a long time. And I think, but this state, obviously, by getting ahead of it with Chapter 152 and the bridges, at least, was we've made a good start.
Mr. Chairman, my other question revolves around legislators proposing or asking the Minnesota Department of Transportation to work on a particular road within their district. I believe Representative Morrow has Highway 14 over in his district. I have it just north of myself there and grew up along a big stretch of it, and it seems like we've been working on Highway 14 for forever. and just wondering, how does the Minnesota Department of Transportation feel about legislators kind of sticking out there that suggestion that it would sure be nice if we could get this done? Or is that really disruptive in your plans? Because we're getting a lot of calls from constituents regarding that, and that highway has had a lot of safety issues and economic issues for a long, long time.
Mr. Henkel, are you poised to answer this one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, and members, my name is Tim Henkel. For the record, I'm an assistant commissioner with MnDOT, responsible for modal planning and program management. And my simple answer, Representative, is we're appreciative of the discretion that the legislature has provided to MnDOT to go through our planning and programming process to identify priorities. We recognize that that priority process is one that has to involve our constituents and priorities can change, but we try to honor and use the planning process that Ms. Reichert has talked about here and Abby McKenzie has talked about in establishing those priorities so we all understand what they are and what's coming.
Yes, if I can just interject an editorial thought, one of the things that we've admired over the years on a bipartisan basis, we have agreed, we as legislators, that we won't place name highway projects or monkey with MnDOT's process too much, because it actually is a rather thoughtful, reasonable, and objective approach to queuing up projects and letting the bids accordingly. Chapter 152 is probably the exception where we actually named a highway, all but named a highway, and actually named bridges, which was a little unusual. I was going to ask you if you wanted to comment on that when we set aside and named the bridges and actually put aside the funding mechanism from that. That was a little unusual that we did that, but we seem to be making it work okay, if I understand. You can react if you wish, and then we'll move to the next questioner.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, to that note, I would say that MnDOT worked very closely with the leaders in the legislature in establishing that list.
Okay,
while we've always been appreciative of a process that allows MnDOT to do that through our criteria-based and performance-based process, we worked so closely that those priorities are working out very well in this process.
And to be fair, the bridges weren't located or picked because of their location or a particular legislator. They were picked because they were fracture critical bridges. And we were hoping to head that off. Thank you for your comments. Representative Vogel, I think you were next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, Ms. Reichert. I don't know. This is one of those things that I've always thought about when I hear these commercials on the radio or see them on TV produced. Do you know what kind of money we spend on advertising from MnDOT? Does MnDOT spend money in advertising,
Ms. Reichert or Mr. Henkel, either?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have the figures. MnDOT certainly is involved in some work in the advertising area, if you want to call it that, in particular in our operations area for maintenance, mm-hmm. especially during the snow plowing season, as an example. We can get you figures on just how much that might be on an annual basis.
I'm just curious as to what that is. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one more question. Mm-hmm. Ms. Reichert, you did say that for $38 billion, we probably could have added a lane to all the highways in the metro area to help ease the congestion, correct? Isn't that kind of what you had said?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that was a very rough.
Okay. Well, and then I'm just curious, as being an outstater, I'm from greater Minnesota, wondering about the railroads that we spent. How much money did we spend on light rail and the other railways here in the metro that we subsidize immensely, that I'm finding out, we subsidize over $24 per rider. How much money did we spend on that rail?
Either one?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer. I mean, this is capital cost that's operating ongoing there.
Well, not just the operating, but the... Mr. Chair, not just the operating cost. I'm talking about the capital it took to build it. Was that about $70 billion? Is that the figure that I had heard? Or where were we at?
No, less than one.
Well, I just was wondering.
To be clear, Ms. Reichert, is this the highway presentation?
Yeah.
And the capital cost for transit, well, we had that a couple weeks ago. It's a good question. It will be coming up again next week with the, or probably starting on Wednesday with the governor's budget proposal being in front of this committee. And when we get transit folks back, if you'd hold that question for them,
I will.
That would be a good one for them to explain.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Eakin, are you ready to go?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Reichert. I guess I was going to address the $38 billion, too. That's a lot of money in that $50 billion gap. And you'd mentioned that they were looking at alternative ways to address the congestion problems other than adding lanes. And the transit was one of them that they saw as a way to actually save money in dealing with the congestion problem. Is that correct?
Ms. Reichert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eakin, on the highway side, providing advantages for the buses, the bus lanes on the freeway system, that's what they're doing. They're trying to do more of that where they do shoulder conversions and let the buses run. So that's one thing. That's a pretty low-cost alternative. We're not talking about light rail or heavy rail systems. We're just talking about things we can do on the highway system to either give advantages for buses, promote carpools, or have like a min-pass lane like on 394 where it's an option if you want to buy to get into a lane during congested time.
And
Representative Eakin.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Reichert, and I was just curious if there's any idea, you said they're kind of recalculating the costs and looking at alternatives besides the adding lanes, and any idea how much will be saved? You know, ballpark figure is what they're looking at and trying to bring that $38 billion down to a more reasonable level.
Ms. Reichert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eakin, I believe that the rough cost estimate for their new strategy is about $6 billion to do a min-pass lane, to do some low-cost congestion mitigation things, treatment all over, finishing 610. They have a plan, and in that they have about $900 million is the revenue, and they have about $6 billion of need. That's just in the mobility area. That's after we take care of the keeping it in state of good repair.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, Ms. Reichert, and I was just curious, how much is that expected to save in the $38 billion? How much is expected to be saved? Are you saying it's $6 billion saved, is what you're saying? Or are you saying that's how much they're going to invest in these alternatives, but then how much will that save?
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative
Ms. Reichert.
That's the, instead of 38, it would be down to 6. So it's a big $6 difference. But you're getting a very different strategy, too. You're buying a different approach.
Okay. Thank you.
There will be, to Representative Eakin's point, MnDOT, Metro, and Met Council did a revision of the transportation performance plan that some of us thought was a little ahead of its time. Nonetheless, it was done, and we'll be having a hearing on that again after we get the budget stuff put to bed in this committee. There's a lot more of these informational hearings to have where we get into the nuts and bolts of philosophy and policy and things like that we'll be visiting for you. Greater Minnesota legislators, I'll warn you, it's metro-centric. You might be bored to tears, but it's very important to the metro area. And then, of course, it does impact, too, what we're doing for capital investment, pavement preservation in greater Minnesota as well. So that's coming up. You can be sure that we'll be having fun things to talk about that. Members, there's no one else on the list. We got plenty of fun things to talk about, but I really want to get on to aeronautics and the Metropolitan Airport Commission today. So if there's any other questions, burning issues you need to talk about at the moment, Ms. Reichert, Mr. Henkel, we will thank you for your testimony and dismiss you and welcome Mr. Chris Roy to the testifier stand. And I think, Chris, there's a handout coming for us, isn't there? Here it is, yes, okay. Oh, members, if you saved it, your save folder from last week, it's probably in there as well. So if you already have it, great. Okay. Well, Travis is handing those out. Mr. Roy, welcome to the committee, and if you'd start talking about one of my favorite areas of MnDOT activity, the Department of Aeronautics.
Well, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Chris Roy. I'm the Office Director for MnDOT for the Office of Aeronautics. Appreciate the opportunity here to give you a quick overview on our office and what aviation in the state of Minnesota does for the state, as well as economic impacts of aviation to the state. What I'll do, I'll just touch on the overview of our aviation system, I'll get involved and talk a little bit about what MnDOT's role in that aviation system is. I'll also address some of the how the state airports fund is revenue is collected and where that money is spent, and then touch briefly on the federal dollars that come into the state for the airports and how that money is spent as well. So kind of an overview of our state aviation system. There's 136 publicly owned airports. 97 of those airports are eligible for federal funds through the FAA. Eight of them are served by airlines and have regularly scheduled service to those eight communities. There's about 11,800 licensed pilots in the state of Minnesota and about 7,100 registered aircraft being home-based here in the state of Minnesota. On an annual basis, there's about 31 million airline passengers, most of those occurring out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, but not exclusively. There's an additional seven airports that also have that registered or the airline service scheduled airline service. And then in addition to that, there's roughly 150 state-owned navigational aids that MnDOT has funded or partially funded in constructing those. Those can range in everything from a weather automated weather station at an airport all the way into instrument approach devices that will help aircraft land in poor weather conditions. This is just a map showing where the different airports are across the state. And geographically, you can see that it's pretty diverse. We also have a pretty wide range of different types of airports. We have everything from MSP, where it's a very very large, highly, very busy airport. And then as you go around the state, you see the red airplanes are the ones that have that commercial or scheduled air service. And then we go all the way down to lighted and turf runways that are also spread out through the state. So we've got really a wide range of airports, but those airports are designed in a way that actually fits the needs of the communities. So moving on to what are the impacts of airports and aviation in the state of Minnesota. Recently, we conducted a study with the University of Minnesota, the CTS section there, and they evaluated the impacts of aviation in the state to be $12.3 billion. That would be direct and indirect jobs as well as any other economic activity associated with an airport. So aviation is a very large industry in the state of Minnesota and adds a lot of value to the state of Minnesota. It also generated, that same study found that it generated 164,000 jobs, and aviation is an important part of business, general aviation, and companies that own their own aircraft use that general aviation in order to get their employees around not only the state but also connecting with the country. But also the commercial and the scheduled airline services that are out there. A lot of businesses use, whether it be Delta or Sun Country Airlines, to fly their individuals around in order to take care of that business. But in addition to business, agriculture plays a very large role in that economic activity that occurs throughout the state through aviation, medical, the air ambulance industry, firefighting, and law enforcement. So State Patrol as well as other law enforcement agencies operate aircraft. And then lastly would be cargo, being one of the larger components of what aviation can do to the state and how it contributes to that $12.3 billion worth of economic activity. So MnDOT's role in all of this is really a severalfold. First of all, we get involved in the safety aspects of all of our publicly owned airports. We go through a process of licensing those airports, and we do that through an evaluation, making sure that there are the airport and the runways are clear of obstructions and that they're meeting the minimum licensing criteria that's set forth in state rules as well as state statute. In addition to that, we go through a zoning process where every airport in the state of Minnesota needs to be zoned prior to receiving any state airport dollars. So we work and administer that zoning process. We work with the airports to make sure that they are properly zoned. And lastly, in that safety component, we also facilitate with the FAA some pilot training and pilot seminars, safety trainings, availabilities at different airports throughout the state. The largest portion of our funds actually go through this section here of airport development, construction, and grants. That's where most of the state airport dollars go, the largest percentage, as well as most of the FAA dollars go into this section. And what we're doing here is very similar to what you heard about earlier on the highway side. This is the infrastructure improvement and rehabilitation projects in there. We've got preservation projects, and that can be on the runway, taxiways, or into some of the buildings as well. Navigational aids is a very large component in the state of Minnesota. We don't have perfect weather around here, so we've got a lot of navigational aids in order to help facilitate pilots coming in and out of airports safely in all weather conditions. And then lastly, in this airport development, we do get into some specialized airport equipment that could be snowplows or other things of that like that would help facilitate having a safe and useful airport.
Mr. Roy, before you get off this slide, Representative Benson has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question about the buildings and airport development and so on, I represent the Rochester area, in fact, the airports in my district. Are you involved in that, the project down there to remodel the...
Mr. Roy?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the state of Minnesota has been involved not only through the FAA grants but also through state grants.
Would you, Mr. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you care to offer any opinion on those? Good project, bad project, or anything of that nature in terms of helping me kind of understand? It's a big part of a sales tax extension project or referendum that the city would like to have the legislature reapprove, you know, the being able to vote. And a component of that, from my understanding, is the airport. So you've been involved in that. So looking at passenger traffic and volumes and the like, something that's needed?
Mr. Roy, you may want to think about identifying the projects Representative Benson might be speaking of on those two. I'm trying to determine which ones they are.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's actually two projects that comes to mind when you speak of this. The first one is the one that's underway. It was a relatively low-cost project, and that was accommodating some changes in luggage and handling of luggage, some improvements and remodeling of the existing terminal building.
Right.
Is that the project that you're speaking of, or the longer-term project?
Yeah, don't comment on the first one, and then certainly on the second one, because I think that is that's a change in location of the whole thing. And I think they're looking at a remodeling of the tower, if I'm not mistaken, as far as this first project, correct?
Mr. Roy?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not certain of the tower component of it. That would be handled probably exclusively through the FAA, but the other components of the project, the remodeling of the terminal building, a certain amount of that just needs to be done in order to accommodate and facilitate things that have taken place and have changed in the airline industry since September 11th.
Okay.
A lot of those accommodations are made in the Rochester terminals, but also some of our other outstate terminals are going through those renovations right now. The other thing that was done was a modernization of the restaurant area inside of the existing terminal building in order to really give kind of the needs that airline travelers are really looking for. And I think it has been quite well received and just recently opened as well. As far as the longer-term project, where the terminal building would be relocated, that's still very, very preliminary in design as well as in location. So I am aware of that, but I don't think there's been any funding identified for what year construction would begin. So it would be a number of years away before any construction would begin there.
Representative Benson?
And Mr. Chairman, just to reserve this answer to this question, but however, the City of Rochester leadership has, as part of a long-term plan to add a high-speed rail system between Rochester and the Twin Cities, and I think their projection is for about 3 million passengers with the type of rail system. When you come back, I guess at some point I'd like to get some kind of response on what your opinion is in terms of what that would do to ridership or, of folks that are using the, is that train going to replace our airport, or is this going to be an improvement to, you know, the opportunities for people to make different modes of travel as a means to get to Rochester?
Should we take that as a rhetorical question, or one we could look at on a high-speed rail debate, or do you want him to try to take a stab at it now?
No, not now, but later, because I would like a thoughtful answer on whether or not that would have an issue.
And perhaps it's another part of the agency that we'll talk about that, but your question and comment is noted. Mr. Roy, proceed. Thank you.
Okay. And we've got three other sections in our office, in MnDOT's Office of Aeronautics. We've got a planning section that takes a look at our long-range plans for aeronautics in the state of Minnesota. That process is just beginning. About every, maybe 4 to 6 years, it's a process that's required by the FAA that we go through and reevaluate those long-term plans. It's very similar to what you just heard about in the 10-year and 20-year plans on the highway side. We also do some revenue forecasting, just to make sure that we're able to properly plan for the revenues that we anticipate coming in our long-range plans. We also administer the aircraft registration for the state of Minnesota. So aircraft that are registered in the state of Minnesota, those bills come out of our office. Any funds that are received also are collected back through our office, as well as something called airline flight property tax, which I'll get a little bit more into on an upcoming slide. And then lastly is we provide air transportation for any state employee. So it goes through the proper authorities and get those permissions, but then we do carry those passengers across the state to facilitate a more cost-effective way of having business done throughout the state. Kind of going out and looking out into the future and what is our work plan and what do we plan on doing in the next handful of months to years is that statewide aviation plan. It is something that's just getting underway right now. We hope to have that plan completed in about 12 months and then have an investment plan that would address the priorities and how we would plan on spending our money come out about 18 months from now. In addition to that, we have something called wide area multilateration. For a relatively large gap of the state of Minnesota, there is currently little to no radar surveillance available at lower altitudes. So somewhere about 8,000 feet above ground and below, you are no longer seen by air traffic control. So that presents a problem for 21 of our airports in the state of Minnesota. They do not have the ability to be seen from the ground. It decreases the efficiency. It also decreases the safety of our system. So what we have proposed to do is work with the FAA and institute a next-generation technology called wide area multilateration that would fill that gap. We're currently working with the FAA, and we believe that we are on track for starting this project and getting it underway very soon. When it's fully turned on and running, it would operate just like a radar would, other than it's using new technologies that's a part of the next-gen solutions. And it would be seen at air traffic control just like a radar would. We're also working with MAC, Metropolitan Airports Commission, in the zoning efforts at their not only, well, their reliever airports is what they're called. We're working with them on that, making sure that they're properly zoned. And then lastly would be maintaining and enhancing scheduled air service. Scheduled air service in the state of Minnesota is something very valuable to a lot of our communities, and our office is working with those communities to try and ensure that scheduled air service would continue. In the last 12 to 15 years, we have lost a lot of air service in the state of Minnesota. Most recently, about a year ago, City of St. Cloud lost air service, and we'd really like to be able to continue having air service at the remaining cities that we do have.
Mr. Roy, back to the long-range plan. You, to be clear, MnDOT Aeronautics has a long-range plan that's always in place. How often do we update it?
In between every 4 and 6 years.
4 to 6 years.
You're exactly right. There is one that's in place right now. We're updating that plan.
And the wide area multilateration, I just want the members to understand that over the last several years we've been trying to work with FAA to put a radar facility near Alexandria, because that's where the hole is, or the thin coverage is a better way to say it, is near the Alexandria area. And in fact, I think there's a $2 million bond that was authorized that's hanging out there. It's one of the unspent bonds that have been authorized but not let, and that responsibility, that's happened because why, Mr. Roy?
Mr. Chair and committee, in dealing with this, the wide area multilateration is actually the system that we're going with is still in the certification basis in the state of Colorado. Going through FAA certification for a new navigational aid or a system like this is a very lengthy and challenging process. Technology-wise, it's a relatively simple one. The technology is there and it's instituted, but a certifying of all the radios and the communication devices to make sure the reliability is as high as it is. So it's a very lengthy process and a very cumbersome process to work through. We're probably in the best position because we're going to be the second one in the state. So we don't have to go, or second one in the country to have a system like this. So we don't have to go through the certification process. We get to ride on the coattails of Colorado in this case. But it is being a very lengthy process, much longer than what I would hope to have gone through, simply because of getting this certified by the FAA before we could actually construct and implement it.
Well, as we're going to be faced with possibly canceling some bonds that have been let for years and that haven't been invested or put to work, I just wanted the committee to understand that MnDOT Aeronautics has been right on top of this. Originally, we were just going to do conventional radar, which looks like that would be early, our old technology is what it's mounted to. And since next-generation navigation stuff is coming, it makes sense if we're going to do this, we might as well do the next generation. And the FAA is dotting I's and crossing T's, as only the FAA can. So good luck with that, Mr. Roy. And if we have to cancel your bonds, we'll try to issue them again when the FAA finally gets their paperwork in order. Thank you. You can proceed.
So moving on to State Airports Fund and how the revenues are collected. This pie chart here just kind of shows where the general three or the three largest components for when you include interest, but where the revenues actually come from. Air flight property tax is a property tax that's assessed scheduled air carriers. That amounts $7.8 million for fiscal year 2010. We got a little bit of interest on the airport fund and the balance of that airport fund of $143,000. Another portion comes from the aviation fuel tax at about $3.375 million, and the last component is aircraft registration at just over $6 million. All of that combined is what is known as the state's airport fund. On the coming slides, what I'll do is describe these three major components in a little bit more detail. The air flight property tax is a property tax that's paid by the airlines in lieu of other taxes. So the companies that can pay air flight property tax do not pay registration on their aircraft. This is a tax that's the rate of that levy is determined by the commissioner, and it's determined in such a way that the airport fund would be sufficiently funded. It is certified by MnDOT and sent to the Department of Revenue at the end of the calendar year, and then paid by those companies, those airline companies, in March, and all the proceeds go into the State Airports Fund. The next component is aviation fuel tax, and how aviation fuel tax in the state of Minnesota is calculated is it's 5 cents per gallon for the first 50,000 gallons. If you use over 50,000 gallons but under 150,000 gallons or any of those purchases in between 50,000 and 150,000, the tax is 2 cents. And as you can see, it's a graduated scale. And our largest users that use over 200,000 gallons, for anything over that 200,000 gallons, would be taxed at a half a cent per gallon. So when you get up into those larger amounts, those are going to be our air carriers, whether it's Delta or any one of the other companies like that. They very well might be up into that range and very early in the year into that half a cent amount. But keep in mind, they're also paying the flight line property tax.
Mr. Roy, would you like to remind the committee of when that formula was first put into play and how many times it's been altered since?
Sure. Mr. Chair and committee, it was put into play well before I was born. I don't know the exact year, but it was in the 1940s, if memory serves, and I don't believe it's been adjusted since then.
Correct. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in regard to that aviation fuel tax, is that comparable to what other states have for aviation fuel taxes?
Mr. Roy?
Mr. Chair and representative, airport funding from state to state is very complicated because there are no two states that fund their airports in the exact same manner. I believe when you take a look at our surrounding states, our fuel tax tend to be on the lower end of fuel taxes in the neighboring states. There are some other states that have a graduated system like this or possibly have different rates for different types of aircrafts. In some instances, jet fuel is taxed at a much lower rate than aviation fuel, which would be more of your Cessna type of aircraft. So it does vary a great deal, but when you compare it to our neighboring states, we tend to be a little bit lower.
Thank you, Representative Szymanski. Good question. We'll talk more about this also as we go along. Continue. Mr. Roy.
The last component is aircraft registration. An aircraft registration in the state of Minnesota is calculated for the first year of that aircraft. When it came off the assembly line and is brand new, we calculate the registration to be 1% of the Blue Book value of that aircraft. And then it's diminished, as you can see on the schedule, for the second year it's 90% of that first year value. And then by the seventh year, it's all the way down to that last bullet where it's either 25% of the first year tax or $50, whichever is greater. So what happens in the state of Minnesota, those that own relatively expensive aircraft, they pay a fair amount in registration. New aircraft can range anywhere from, you know, probably about $5 million on up to $25, $30 million. So you can see 1% of that type of value of an aircraft can amount to a fairly large sum of money paid in aircraft registration. On the other end of the spectrum, though, the $50, we do have quite a few aircraft paying that minimal amount or down in that value as well.
Members, as Mr. Roy's about to start on the airport fund expenditure, I just want to take a moment to point out, and Representative Szymanski kind of sparked the thought, among all the 50 states and their airport funds and their aeronautics commissions, we're one of the few, I believe, Mr. Roy, that gets no general fund appropriations to run their airport system. The entire airport system, both the Metropolitan Airport Commission, which we'll hear from a little later, and the Department of Aeronautics get no general fund money. It's all user fee based, which is part of why we had so much heartburn on the $15 million appropriation we had a few years ago when we took money from the airport fund and put it in the general fund to help close a budget gap. We'll be talking more about that a little later. But I just wanted to be clear, because Mr. Roy is being very modest when he talks about how we're unique from the states, in that I want you to understand we get no general fund money to run any of our airports, either the Metropolitan Airport Commission's system or the 136 public use airports Mr. Roy is responsible for. Okay, fund expenditures or question, Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
By the way, Representative Eakin, what's your registration fee this year on your airplane?
Well, I'm in a flying club, so I don't own it.
Mine's 92 whole bucks, and I'm happy to spend it, just so you know. But anyhow, Representative Eakin, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question about the slide on the bottom of page 4, where it shows the pie chart on the state airports fund, the revenues. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, since it started, what kind of shift there has been. And I don't know if you can tell me that or not, but as far as the share of the pie that, for instance, the property tax or the aviation fuel tax has paid into the state airport fund in the past. Has there been a significant shift in where the revenue has been coming from?
Mr. Roy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, over the last maybe 5 to 7 years, this is pretty representative of what's happened. Prior to that, though, what had happened was aircraft registration has grown quite a bit. So from maybe about the mid-90s through the early 2000s, aircraft registration and the revenues from aircraft registration has grown. But if you look at from probably about 2003-04 forward, this is pretty representative as to how the airport fund has been funded.
Representative Eakin, if I can take a stab at that. Since I've been here, the flight line property tax that the airlines pay actually has been reduced a couple times by about, I believe, $2 million, if I'm not mistaken. One of the things that's also changed is that interest income number. Members, and we'll talk about this more when we get into the budgeting process, but for years, several years, Aeronautics carried about $18 or $19 million in an investment account. That had a lot to do with previous legislatures not authorizing aeronautics to actually spend the money they were collecting. Even though there was no general fund attached, every time we had a general fund emergency, the legislature would say, no, everybody has to cut back. So even aeronautics, who had their own user fee base, was not allowed to spend money, so they just merrily put it away in CDs or whatever you were putting it in. So the interest income was actually a couple million dollars a year at one time. And then, of course, we saw that in 2003 and took $15 million out of your investment account, and that number is now a much smaller number. So we'll want to hold that thought going forward as to why we want them to put the money to work or something like that instead of putting it in an interest-bearing account. But they have changed a little bit. Thank you for the question, Representative Eakin. Further questions, or Mr. Roy, you can continue or attempt to continue until we'll pepper you with some more questions.
So on the previous slides, you saw how the revenue side of the state airports fund This is the expenditure side. 50% of the airport fund goes directly back into the airports through what we call construction grants, and that would be everything from your typical construction grant, reconstructing a runway, paving a runway, all the way into those maintenance equipment purchases that would be funded through the state airports fund, which could include snow plows and the like there. The next largest portion is the maintenance. That green portion there of 18%, that's paid directly to the airports through the state airport fund, and that's for maintaining their airports. So it's a reimbursable item that would be paid back to the airports as they expend money on snow removal or mowing in the summertime and eliminating some of the hazards that are associated with grass growing up too close to a runway. The next largest portion is the admin support at 16%. That covers the salaries of the office as well as our building, this morning we found we got another leak in. So we've got a leaky roof. So it covers things like that. And then nav aids would be 8%. So all of the navigational aids that are state-funded takes up roughly 8% of the expenditures from the state airport fund. Operations would be paying for the electricity to run those navigational aids as well as administering the inspection and license program that we do have for the publicly owned airports. And then lastly, we do have some other relatively small programs. We got 0.5% of the airport's fund going to education, about 0.3% going to the Civil Air Patrol, and about 1% of the airport's fund going to air service marketing grants. Now turning to the federal side and the FAA expenditures, FAA funded in fiscal year 2010 approximately 140 different projects. All of those projects occurred at the 97 federally funded or federally eligible airports across the state. So more than one project per airport at several locations. Those projects are funded by federal law at a 95.5% match. So you, on one of those projects, it can be as high as 95% federal dollars going to match the 5% local funds. And then how that money is broken out. In fiscal year 2010, we got a total of $83.5 million of federal funds. $12.5 million were primary entitlements, which went to our air carrier service airports. $14 million were divided among the remaining 89 airports that are in the federal program but do not have that air carrier service at their airport. And then the remaining components of the apportionment and discretion are prioritized between MnDOT and FAA staff and determined based on priority need as to which projects should receive funding. And then as a part of that $83 million, there was also some ARRA dollars or economic stimulus projects that were expended in that fiscal year as well. As a whole, all of our construction grants are broken down into this pie chart here. So this is a combination between the State Airports Fund as well as the FAA dollars. You can see that our construction grants, 45% of it goes towards airport pavements and lighting. The second largest component in this past fiscal year was 32% going towards buildings. This is a little unusually high. And why that is because we've got some very large terminal remodeling projects out there right now. We've got the Duluth Terminal, the Bemidji and Brainerd Terminals, and then the Rochester Terminal. All of these are happening right up at this time because of the impacts of 9/11 and TSA and screening. Most of our outstate airports were not very well accommodated for having people come through screening and then be on the secure side for any length of time. In most of our outstate airports, there are no bathroom facilities, there's no eating facilities on the post-screen side of the airport. So it did add a lot of complications. It was pretty challenging for many of these airports to function like that, but it took some time to fully understand what the impacts are of the TSA and how they would like to operate and then develop those projects. So now we're finally seeing those projects be in construction, and that's why that 32% goes towards building. A more typical year would have probably half or more of that 32% probably being spent back into the airport pavements and the infrastructure of the airport that's actually on the air side of things.
Mr. Roy, Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Roy, when you talked about outstate airports and TSA issues, it reminded me that We made national news in the summer of 2009 at the Rochester Airport when that Continental Express jet was stuck there overnight. And I understand that wasn't really an issue for MnDOT or even the Rochester Airport, that that had to do with airline personnel and policies. But are you confident that from coming out of that experience that we're not going to have a repeat of that? You know, I think one of the issues had to do with the TSA and lack of personnel at that hour. Have the necessary things been are in place to prevent something like that from happening again? Because that a lot of that had to do with personnel on the ground at the Rochester Airport.
Mr. Roy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there's been a lot learned from that lesson. However, what I would like to say is the personnel that are actually employed by the Rochester Airport were doing everything they possibly could to try and fix that situation as quickly as possible. It was a combination between TSA, possibly FAA, and then the people in the aircraft, in the airline industry, just having some difficulties in communicating as to what the proper procedure were or would be, should be, in getting those passengers off of that aircraft. That put into place a couple of changes on the federal side. There's the bill that was passed here that about a year ago on the passengers' rights, Bill of Rights, which I think airline industry has taken to heart, and it really tries to practice. All of our outstate airports, as well as MSP, do everything that they possibly can to make sure the comfort of the passengers is properly met. So I'd really like to believe, and I think it's a lot of action has been taken, but I don't think we'll have an incident like that again to occur probably anywhere in the U.S., but certainly here in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Roy, on that last slide also, you have a land zoning planning is 11% of all those dollars. Does that include actually acquiring land to prevent development in, like, runway safety zones and so on? Because it looks like a big number.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I believe it does include the land grants. We do participate in the purchase of land at airports in order to preserve the proper clear zones and runway protection zones off the end of runways. I could double-check that number, but looking at the percentages, I would tend to believe that it does include that acquisition cost.
Any concluding remarks, further questions for Mr. Roy? Mr. Roy, thank you for the report. We'll look forward to talking to you again when the budget is out. Appreciate it. Members, we have the Metropolitan Airport Commission presentation, and we really need a good half hour for that. They have a fascinating story to tell as well about having one of the best-run airports in the United States, again, with no general fund dollars. Mr. Hamill, you don't have the new chair with you today, do you? If you come back on Monday, would he be here, and would he bring brownies for the committee or something? Or I'm kidding, Mr. It'd be nice if he wants to stop by and say hello. We'd love to welcome him, and if you can hold till Monday, we'd appreciate that. Can make that work? Outstanding. Thank you. Well, members, we'll hold that committee report till Monday. I know it's President's Day, but we'll have Mr. Hamill and Mr. Killian come out and do that presentation. And also, Ms. Zewers had put together the spreadsheet that she's holding for you. I think you'll find it very useful, and she'll give you that presentation on Monday as well. Anything else come before the committee today? Thank you for your attention and for your good questions, members. We are adjourned.